covered, watching Keeley fight to no avail, wings barely flapping as Petra screamed again. Begging. Begging Iskra to stop. Now, Abraxos! She kicked him with her spurs. He again refused to dive. Then Iskra barked a command to her wyvern, and the beast let go of Keeley. There was a second scream then, from the mountain, from the blue blood matron, screaming for her daughter as she plummeted down to the rocks below. The other blue bloods whirled, but they were too far away, their wyverns too slow to stop that fatal plunge. But Abraxos was not. And Manon didn't know if she gave the command or thought it. But that scream, that mother's scream she'd never heard before, made her lean in. Abraxos dove, a shooting star with his glistening wings. They dove and dove for the broken wyvern and the still-living witch upon it. Keeley was still breathing, Manon realized as they neared, the wind tearing at her face and clothes. Keeley was still breathing, and fighting like hell to keep steady. Not to survive. Keeley knew she would be dead any moment. She was fighting for the witch on her back. Petra had passed out, twisted in her saddle, from the plunge or the loss of air. She dangled precariously, even as Keeley fought with her last heartbeats to keep the fall smooth and slow. The wyvern's wings buckled, and she yelped in pain. Abraxos hurtled in, wings spread as he made one pass and then a second, the canyon appearing too fast below. By the time he finished the second glide, almost close enough to touch that blood-stained leathery hide, Manon understood. He couldn't stop Keeley. She was too heavy and he too small. Yet they could save Petra. He'd seen Asterin make that jump, too. She had to get the unconscious witch out of the saddle. Abraxos roared at Keeley, and Manon could have sworn that he was speaking some alien language, some bellowing command, as Keeley made one final stand for her rider and leveled out flat. A landing platform. "My Keeley," Petra had said. Had smiled as she said it. Manon told herself it was for an alliance, told herself it was for show. But all she could see was the unconditional love in that dying wyvern's eyes, as she unbuckled her harness, stood from the saddle, and leapt off Abraxos. Chapter 62. Manon hit Keeley, and the beast screamed, but held on as Manon hauled herself against the wind and into the saddle where Petra dangled. Her hands were stiff, her gloves making her even clumsier as she sliced with a blade through the leathers, one after another. Abraxos roared his warning. The canyon mouth loomed closer. Darkness have mercy on her. Then Manon had Petra free, the blue blood air a dead weight in her arms, her hair whipping Manon's face like a thousand small knives. She lashed a length of leather around herself and Petra. Once. Twice. She tied it, lacing her arms through Petra's. Keeley kept steady. The canyon lips closed around them, shadow everywhere. Manon bellowed at the weight as she hauled the witch up out of the stirrups and the saddle. Rocks pushed past, but a shadow blotted out the sun, and there was Abraxos, diving for her, plummeting, small and sleek. He was the only wyvern she'd seen bank at that speed in this canyon. "Thank you," she said to Keeley, as she flung herself and Petra into the air. They fell for a heartbeat, twisting and dropping too fast. But then Abraxos was there, his claws outstretched. He swept them up, banking along the side of the canyon and over the lip, rising into the safety of the air. Keeley hit the floor of the canyon with a crash that could be heard across the mountains. She did not rise again. The Black Beaks won the war games, and Manon was crowned wing leader in front of all those frilly, sweating men from Otterlin. They called her a hero, a true warrior, and more nonsense like that. But Manon had seen her grandmother's face when she had set Petra down on the viewing platform. Seen the disgust. Manon ignored the blue blood matron, who had gotten on her knees to thank her. She did not even see Petra as she was carried off. The next day, rumor had it, Petra would not rise from bed. They said she had been broken in her soul when Keeley died. An unfortunate accident brought on by uncontrollable wyverns, the Yellowlegs matron had claimed, and Iskra had echoed. But Manon had heard Iskra's command to kill. She might have called Iskra out, might have challenged her, if Petra hadn't heard that command too. The vengeance was Petra's to claim. She should have let the witch die, her grandmother screamed at her that night, as she struck Manon again and again for her lack of obedience, lack of brutality, lack of discipline. Manon did not apologize. She could not stop hearing the sound made as Keeley hit the earth. And some part of her, perhaps a weak and undisciplined part, did not regret ensuring the animal's sacrifice had not been in vain. From everyone else, Manon endured the praise heaped on her and accepted the bows from every god's damned coven, no matter their bloodline. Wing leader. She said it to herself, silently, as she and Asterin, half of the 13 trailing behind them, approached the mess hall where the celebration was to be held. The other half were already there, scouting ahead for any possible threat or trap. Now that she was wing leader, now that she had humiliated Iskra, others would be even more vicious, to put her down and claim her position. The crowd was merry, iron teeth glinting all around, and ale, real fresh ale brought in by those awful men from Otterlin, sloshing in mugs. Manon had shoved one into her hand, and Asterin yanked it away, drank a mouthful, and waited a moment before she gave it back. "They're not above poisoning you," her second said, winking as they made their way to the front of the room where the three matrons were waiting. Those men at the games had held a small ceremony, but this was for the witches. This was for Manon. She hid her smile as the crowd parted, letting her through. The three high witches were seated in makeshift thrones, little more than ornate chairs they'd found. The blue blood matron smiled as Manon pressed two fingers to her brow. The yellow legs matron, on the other end, did nothing. But her grandmother, seated in the center, smiled faintly. A snake's smile. "Welcome, wing leader," her grandmother said, and a cry went up from the witches, save for the 13, who stayed cool and quiet. They did not need to cheer, for they were immortal and infinite and gloriously, wonderfully deadly. "What gift can we give you? What crown can we bestow to honor what you shall do for us?" her grandmother mused. "You have a fine blade, a fearsome coven." The 13 all allowed a hint of a smirk. "What else could we give you that you do not possess?" Manon bowed her head. "There is nothing I wish for, save the honor which you have already given me." Her grandmother laughed. "What about a new cloak?" Manon straightened. She could not refuse, but this was her cloak. It had always been. "That one is looking rather shabby," her grandmother went on, waving her hand to someone in the crowd. "So here is our gift to you, wing leader. A replacement." There were grunts and curses, but the crowd gasped, in hunger, in anticipation, as a brown-haired, shackled witch was hauled forward by three Yellowlegs cronies and forced to her knees before Manon. If her broken face, shattered fingers, lacerations, and burns did not give away what she was, then the blood-red cloak she wore did. The Kraken Witch, her eyes the solid color of freshly tilled earth, looked up at Manon. How those eyes were so bright despite the horrors written on her body. How she didn't collapse right there or start begging, Manon didn't know.
"A gift," said her grandmother, extending an iron-tipped hand toward the Kraken. "Worthy of my granddaughter. End her life and take your new cloak."
Manon recognized the challenge, yet she drew her dagger, and Astarin stepped in close, eyes on the Kraken. For a moment, Manon stared down at the witch, her mortal enemy. The Krakens had cursed them, made them eternal exiles. They deserved to die, each and every one of them. But it was not her voice that said those things in her head. No, for some reason, it was her grandmother's.
"At your leisure, Manon,"
her grandmother cooed. Choking, her lips cracked and bleeding, the Kraken witch looked up at Manon and chuckled.
"Manon Blackbeak,"
she whispered in what might have been a drawl had her teeth not been broken, her throat ringed with bruises.
"I know you."
"Kill the bitch!"
a witch shouted from the back of the room. Manon looked into her enemy's face and raised her brows.
"You know what we call you."
Blood welled as the Kraken's lips peeled into a smile. She closed her eyes as if savoring it.
"We call you the White Demon. You're on our list. The list of all you monsters to kill on sight if we ever run into you. And you."
She opened her eyes and grinned, defiant, furious.
"You are at the top of that list for all that you have done."
"It's an honor,"
Manon said to the Kraken, smiling enough to show her teeth.
"Cut out her tongue!"
someone else called.
"End her,"
Astarin hissed. Manon flipped the dagger, angling it to sink into the Kraken's heart. The witch laughed, but it turned into a cough that had her heaving until blue blood splattered on the floor, until tears were leaking from her eyes, and Manon caught a glimpse of the deep, infected wounds on her chest. When she lifted her head, blood staining the corners of her mouth, she smiled again.
"Look all you want. Look at what they did to me, your sisters. How it must pain them to know they couldn't break me in the end."
Manon stared down at her ruined body.
"Do you know what this is, Manon Blackbeak?"
the Kraken said.
"Because I do. I heard them say what you did during your games."
Manon wasn't sure why she was letting the witch talk, but she couldn't have moved if she wanted to.
"This,"
the Kraken said for all to hear,
"is a reminder. My death, my murder at your hands, is a reminder. Not to them,"
she breathed, pinning Manon with that soil-brown stare.
"But to you. A reminder of what they made you to be. They made you this way. You want to know the Grand Kraken's secret,"
she went on.
"Our great truth that we keep from you, that we guard with our lives. It is not where we hide, or how to break your curse. You have known all this time how to break it. You have known for 500 years that your salvation lies in your hands alone. No. Our great secret is that we pity you.
No one was speaking now. But the Kraken did not break Manon's stare, and Manon did not lower her dagger.
We pity you, each and every one of you, for what you do to your children. They are not born evil, but you force them to kill and hurt and hate until there is nothing left inside of them, of you. That is why you are here tonight, Manon. Because of the threat you pose to that monster you call Grandmother. The threat you posed when you chose mercy and saved your rival's life.
She gasped for breath, tears flowing unabashedly as she bared her teeth.
They have made you into monsters. Made, Manon. And we feel sorry for you.
Enough, the matron said from behind. But the whole room was silent, and Manon slowly raised her eyes to her grandmother's. In them, Manon beheld a promise of the violence and pain that would come if she disobeyed. Beyond that, there gleamed nothing but satisfaction. As if the Kraken had spoken true, but only the Blackbeak matron knew she had done so. The Kraken's eyes were still bright with a courage Manon could not comprehend.
Do it,
the Kraken whispered. Manon wondered if anyone else understood that it was not a challenge, but a plea. Manon angled her dagger again, flipping it in her palm. She did not look at the Kraken, or at her grandmother, or anyone, as she gripped the witch by the hair and yanked back her head. And then spilled her throat on the floor. Legs dangling off a cliff edge, Manon sat on a plateau atop a peak in the ruins. Abraxo sprawled at her side, smelling the night-blooming flowers on the spring meadow. She'd had no choice but to take the Kraken's cloak, to dump her old one atop the body once it fell, once the witches gathered around to rip her apart.
They have made you into monsters.
Manon looked at her wyvern, the tip of his tail waving like a cat's. No one had noticed when she left the celebration. Even Asterin was drunk on the Kraken's blood and had lost sight of Manon slipping through the crowd. She told Sorrel, though, that she was going to see Abraxos. And her third, somehow, had let her go alone. They'd flown until the moon was high, and she could no longer hear the shrieks and cackles of the witches and the Omega. Together they sat on the last of the runes, and she gazed across the endless flat expanse between the peaks and the western sea. Somewhere out there, beyond the horizon, was a home that she had never known. Krakens were liars and insufferably preachy. The witch had probably enjoyed giving her little speech, making some grand last stand.
We feel sorry for you.
Manon rubbed at her eyes and braced her elbows on her knees, peering into the drop below. She would have dismissed her, wouldn't have thought twice about it, if it hadn't been for that look in Keeley's eyes as she fell, fighting with every last scrap of strength to save her Petra, or for Abraxos's wing, sheltering Manon against icy rain. The wyverns were meant to kill and maim and strike terror into the hearts of their enemies. And yet. Manon looked toward the star-flecked horizon, leaning her face into a warm spring breeze, grateful for the steady, solid companion lounging behind her. A strange feeling, that gratitude for his existence. Then there was that other strange feeling, that pushed and pulled at her, making her replay the scene in the mess hall again and again. She had never known regret. Not true regret, anyway. But she regretted not knowing the Kraken's name. She regretted not knowing who the new cloak on her shoulders had belonged to, where she had come from, how she had lived. Somehow, even though her long life had been gone for 10 years, somehow, that regret made her feel incredibly, heavily mortal. Chapter 63. Adian let out a low whistle and offered Kaol the bottle of wine between them on the rooftop of Selena's apartment. Kaol, not feeling at all like drinking, shook his head.
I wish I had been there to see it.
He gave Kaol a wolfish smile.
I'm surprised you're not condemning me for saying that. Whatever creatures the king sent with Narok, I do not think they were innocent men,
Kaol said.
Or really men at all anymore.
She had done it. Had made such a statement that even days later, Adian was still celebrating. Quietly, of course. Kaol had come here tonight planning to tell Adian and Ren what he knew of the spell the king had used and how they might destroy it. But he hadn't yet. He still wondered what Adian would do with that knowledge, especially once Kaol left for Aniel in 3 days.
When she gets home, you need to lie low in Aniel,
Adian said, swigging from the bottle.
Once it comes out who she was all these years.
And it would, Kaol knew. He was already preparing to get Dorian and Sorsha out of the castle. Even if they had done nothing wrong, they had been her friends. If the king knew that Selena was Aelin, it could be just as deadly as if he discovered that Dorian had magic. When she came home, everything would change. Yes, Aelin would come home, but not to Kaol. She would come home to Terrasen, to Adian and Ren and the court that was regathering in her name. She would come home to war and bloodshed and responsibility. Part of him still could not fathom what she'd done to Narok, the battle cry she'd issued from across the sea. He could not accept that part of her, so bloodthirsty and unyielding. Even as Selena, it had been hard to swallow at times, and he had tried to look past it. But as Aelin, he'd known, since the moment he figured out who she was, that while Selena would always pick him, Aelin would not. And it would not be Selena Sardothian who returned to this continent. It would take time, he knew, for it to stop hurting, to let go. But the pain wouldn't last forever.
Is there... Adian clenched his jaw, as if debating saying the rest. Is there anything you want me to tell her? Or give her?
At any moment, any time, Adian might have to flee to Terrasen and to his queen. The eye of Elena was warm at his neck, and Kaol almost reached for it. But he couldn't bring himself to send her that message, or to let go of her that completely. Not yet. Just as he couldn't bring himself to tell Adian about the clock tower.
Tell her, Kaol said quietly, that I had nothing to do with you. Tell her you barely spoke to me, or Dorian. Tell her I am fine in Aniel, and that we are all safe.
Adian was quiet long enough that Kaol got up to leave. But then the general said,
What would you have given just to see her again?
Kaol couldn't turn around as he said,
It doesn't matter now.
Sorsha rested her head on the soft spot between Dorian's shoulder and chest, breathing in the smell of him. He was already sleeping deeply. Almost. They had almost taken things over the edge tonight, but she had again hesitated, again let that stupid doubt creep in when he asked her if she was ready. And though she wanted to say yes, she had said no. She lay awake, stomach tight and mind racing. There was so much she wanted to do and see with him. But she could feel the world shifting, the wind changing. Aelin Galathinius was alive. And even if Sorsha gave everything to Dorian, the upcoming weeks and months would be trying enough for him without having to worry about her. If the captain and the prince decided to act on their knowledge, if magic was freed, it would be chaos. People might go as mad from its sudden return as they'd gone from its departure. She didn't want to think what the king would do. Yet no matter what happened tomorrow, or next week, or next year, she was grateful. Grateful to the gods, to fate, to herself for being brave enough to kiss him that night. Grateful for this little bit of time she'd been given with him. She still thought about what the captain had said all those weeks ago. About being queen. But Dorian needed a true queen if he was to survive this. Someday, perhaps, she'd have to face the choice of letting him go for the greater good. She was still quiet and small. If she could hardly stand up to Amethy, how could she ever be expected to fight for her country? No, she could not be queen, for there were limits to her bravery and to what she could offer. But for now she could be selfish for a little longer. For 2 days, Kaol continued to plan an escape for Dorian and Sorsha, Adian working with him. They hadn't objected when he'd explained, and there had even been a hint of relief in the prince's eyes. They would all go tomorrow, when Kaol left for Aniel. It was the perfect excuse to get them out of the castle. They wanted to accompany their friend for a day or two before bidding him farewell. He knew Dorian would try to return to Rifthold, that he'd have to fight him on it. But at least they could both agree that Sorsha was to get out. Some of Adian's own belongings were already at the apartment, where Ren continued to gather resources for them all. Just in case. Kaol had turned in his formal suggestions for his replacement to the king, and the announcement would be made tomorrow morning. After all these years, all that planning and hoping and working, he was leaving. He hadn't been able to bring himself to leave his sword to his replacement, as he should have done. Tomorrow. He only had to get through tomorrow. But there was no way Kaol could prepare for the summons he received from the King of Otterlin to meet him in his private council chamber. When he arrived, Adian was already inside. Surrounded by 15 guards Kaol did not recognize, all wearing those tunics with the royal wyvern embroidered with black thread. The King of Otterlin was grinning. Dorian heard within minutes that Adian and Kaol had been summoned to his father's private council room. As soon as he heard, he ran. Not for Kaol, but to Sorsha. He almost collapsed with relief when he found her in her workroom. But he willed strength to his knees as he crossed the room in a few strides and grabbed her hand.
"We're getting out. Now. You are getting out of this castle right now, Sorsha."
She pulled back.
"What happened? Tell me, what?"
"We're going now,"
he panted.
"Oh, I don't think so." Someone purred from the open doorway.
He turned to find Amethy, the old healer, standing there, arms crossed and smiling faintly. Dorian could do nothing, as half a dozen unfamiliar guards appeared behind her, and she said,
"The king wants to see you both in his chambers. Immediately."
Chapter 64. In the council room high in the glass castle, Adian had already marked the exits and considered what furniture he could use as a defense or as a weapon. They'd taken his sword when they'd come for him in his rooms, though they hadn't shackled him. A lethal mistake. The captain wasn't shackled either. In fact, the fools had left him armed. The captain was doing his best to look vaguely confused as the king watched them from his glass throne.
"What an interesting night this has turned out to be. What interesting information my spies have brought me,"
the king said, looking from Adian to Kaol to Dorian and his woman.
"My most talented general is found to be sneaking around Rifthold in the dead of night, after spending so much of my gold on parties he does not even bother attending. And he has somehow, despite years of animosity, become close with my captain of the guard. While my son..."
Adian did not envy the smile the king gave the crown prince.
"Has apparently been dabbling with the rabble. Again."
To his credit, Dorian snarled and said,
"Consider your words carefully, father."
"Oh?"
The king raised a thick, scarred brow.
"I had it on good authority that you were planning to run away with this healer. Why would you ever do such a thing?"
The prince's throat bobbed, but he kept his head high.
"Because I can't stand the thought of her spending another minute in this festering shithole that you call a court."
Adian couldn't help but admire him for it, for yielding nothing until the king showed his hand. Smart man. Brave man. But it might not be enough to get them out of this alive.
"Good,"
the king said.
"Neither can I."
He waved a hand, and before Adian could bark a warning, the guards separated the prince and the girl. Four held Dorian back, and two forced Sorsha to kneel with a kick behind the knees. She cried out as she hit the marble, but went silent. The whole room went silent, as a third guard pulled a sword and placed it lightly on the back of her slender neck.
"Don't you dare,"
Dorian growled. Adian looked to Kaol, but the captain was frozen. These were not his guards. Their uniforms were those of the men who had hunted Wren. They had the same dead eyes, the same vileness that had made him not at all regret killing their colleagues in the alley. He'd taken down six that night with minimal damage. How many could he cut down now? His gaze met the captain's, and the captain flicked his eyes to the guard who held Adian's sword. That would be one of his first moves. Get Adian a sword so they could fight. Because they would fight. They would fight their way out of this, or to their deaths. The king said to Dorian,
"I would choose your next words carefully, prince."
Kaol couldn't start the fight, not with that sword resting on Sorsha's neck. That was his first goal, get the girl out alive. Then Adian. Dorian the king wouldn't kill. Not here, not in this way. But Adian and Sorsha had to get away, and that could not happen until the king called off the guard. Then Dorian spoke.
"Let her go, and I'll tell you anything."
Dorian took a step toward his father, palms out.
"She has nothing to do with whatever this is. Whatever you think has happened."
"But you do?"
The king was still smiling. There was a carved round bit of familiar black stone resting on the small table beside the king. From the distance, Kaol couldn't see what it was, but it made his stomach turn over regardless.
Tell me, son. Why were General Ash River and Captain Westfall meeting these months?
I don't know.
The king clicked his tongue, and the guard raised his sword to strike. Kaol started forward as Sorsha sucked in a breath.
No, stop!
Dorian flung out a hand.
Then answer the question.
I am, you bastard, I am! I don't know why they were meeting.
The guard's sword still remained up, ready to fall before Kaol could move an inch.
Do you know that there has been a spy in my castle for several months now, Prince? Someone feeding information to my enemies and plotting against me with a known rebel leader?
Shit. Shit. He had to mean Wren. The king knew who Wren was, had sent those men to hunt him down.
Just tell me who, Dorian, and you can do whatever you wish with your friend.
The king didn't know then if it was he or Adian or both of them who had been meeting with Wren. He didn't know how much they'd learned about his plans, his control over magic. Adian was somehow still keeping his mouth shut, somehow still looking ready for battle. Adian, who had survived for so long without hope, holding together his kingdom as best he could, who would never see the queen he so fiercely loved. He deserved to meet her, and she deserved to have him serve in her court. Kaol took a breath, preparing himself for the words that would doom him. But it was Adian who spoke.
You want a spy? You want a traitor?
The general drawled, and flung his replicated black ring on the floor.
Then here I am. You want to know why the captain and I were meeting? It was because your stupid bastard of a boy captain figured out that I'd been working with one of the rebels. He's been blackmailing information out of me for months to give to his father to offer you when the Lord of Aniel needed a favor. And you know what?
Adian grinned at them all, the northern wolf incarnate. If the king was shocked about the ring, he didn't show it.
All you monsters can burn in hell, because my queen is coming, and she will spike you to the walls of your god's damned castle. And I can't wait to help her gut you like the pigs you are.
He spat at the king's feet, right on top of the fake ring that had stopped bouncing. It was flawless. The rage and the arrogance and the triumph. But as he stared each of them down, Kaol's heart fractured. Because for a flicker, as those turquoise eyes met with his, there was none of that rage or triumph. Only a message to the queen that Adian would never see. And there were no words to convey it. The love and the hope and the pride. The sorrow at not knowing her as the woman she had become. The gift Adian thought he was giving her in sparing Kaol's life. Kaol nodded slightly, because he understood that he could not help. Not at this point. Not until that sword was removed from Sorsha's neck. Then he could fight. And he might still get them out alive. Adian didn't struggle, as the guards clapped shackles around his wrists and ankles.
I've always wondered about that ring, the king said. Was it the distance, or some true strength of spirit that made you so unresponsive to its suggestions? But regardless, I am so glad that you confessed to treason, Adian.
He spoke with slow, deliberate glee.
So glad you did it in front of all these witnesses, too. It will make your execution that much easier. Though I think...
The king smiled and looked at the fake black ring.
I think I'll wait. Perhaps give it a month or two. Just in case any last-minute guests have to travel a long, long way for the execution. Just in case someone gets it into her head that she can rescue you.
Adian snarled. Kaol bit back his own reaction. Perhaps the king had never had anything on them. Perhaps this had only been a ruse to get Adian to confess to something. Because the king knew that the general would offer up his own life instead of an innocence. The king wanted to savor this, and savor the trap that he had now set for Aelin, even if it cost him a fine general in the process. Because once she heard that Adian was captured, once she knew the execution date, she would run to Rifthold. After she comes for you, Adian promised the king. They'll have to scrape what's left of you off the walls. The king only smiled. Then he looked to Dorian and Sorsha, who seemed to be hardly breathing. The healer remained on the floor and did not lift her head as the king braced his massive forearms on his knees and said,
"And what do you have to say for yourself, girl?"
She trembled, shaking her head.
"That's enough," Dorian snapped, sweat gleaming on his brow. The prince winced in pain as his magic was repressed by the iron in his system.
"Adian confessed. Now let her go." "Why should I release the true traitor in this castle?"
Sorsha couldn't stop shaking as the king spoke. All her years of remaining invisible, all her training, first from those rebels in Fenharrow, then the contacts they'd sent her family to in Rifthold, all of it ruined.
"Such interesting letters you send to your friend. Why, I might not ever have read them,"
the king said,
"if you hadn't left one in the rubbish for your superior to find. See, you rebels have your spies, and I have mine. And as soon as you decided to start using my son..."
She could feel the king smirking at her.
"How many of his movements did you report to your rebel friends? What secrets of mine have you given away over the years?"
"Leave her alone,"
Dorian growled. It was enough to set her crying. He still thought she was innocent. And maybe he could get out of this, if he was surprised enough by the truth. If the king saw his son's shock and disgust. So Sorsha lifted her head, even as her mouth trembled, even as her eyes burned, and stared down the king of Otterlin.
"You destroyed everything that I had, and you deserve everything that's to come," she said.
Then she looked at Dorian, whose eyes were indeed wide, his face bone white.
"I was not supposed to love you, but I did. I do. And there is so much I wish we could have done together, seen together."
The prince just stared at her, then walked to the foot of the dais and dropped to his knees.
"Name your price,"
he said to his father.
"Ask it of me, but let her go. Exile her, banish her, anything. Say it, and it will be done."
She began shaking her head, trying to find the words to tell him that she hadn't betrayed him. Not her prince. The king, yes. She had reported his movements for years, in each carefully written letter to her friend. But never Dorian. The king looked at his son for a long moment. He looked at the captain and Adian, so quiet and so tall, beacons of hope for their future. Then he looked again at his son, on his knees before the throne, on his knees for her, and said,
"No. No."
Kaol thought he had not heard it, the word that cleaved through the air just before the guard's sword did. one blow from that mighty sword. That was all it took to sever Sorsha's head. The scream that erupted out of Dorian was the worst sound that Kaol had ever heard. Worse even than the wet, heavy thud of her head hitting the red marble. Adian began roaring, roaring and cursing at the king, thrashing against his chains. But the guards hauled him away, and Kaol was too stunned to do anything other than watch the rest of Sorsha's body topple to the ground. And then Dorian, still screaming, was scrambling through the blood toward it, toward her head, as if he could put it back, as if he could piece her together. Chapter 65. Kaol hadn't been able to move a muscle from the moment the guard cut off Sorsha's head, to the moment Dorian, still kneeling in a pool of her blood, stopped screaming.
"That is what awaits traitors," the king said to the silent room.
And Kaol looked at the king, at his shattered friend, and drew his sword. The king rolled his eyes.
"Put away your sword, captain. I've no interest in your noble antics. You're to go home to your father tomorrow. Don't leave this castle in disgrace."
Kaol kept his sword drawn.
"I will not go to Aniel," he growled. "And I will not serve you a moment longer. There is one true king in this room. There always has been. And he is not sitting on that throne."
Dorian stiffened. But Kaol went on.
"There is a queen in the north, and she has already beaten you once. She will beat you again. And again, because what she represents, and what your son represents, is what you fear most. Hope. You cannot steal it, no matter how many you rip from their homes and enslave. And you cannot break it, no matter how many you murder."
The king shrugged.
"Perhaps. But maybe I can start with you."
He flicked his fingers at the guards.
"Kill him, too."
Kaol whirled to the guards behind him and crouched, ready to fight a path out for himself and Dorian. Then a crossbow snapped, and he realized there had been others in the room, hidden behind impossibly thick shadows. He had only enough time to twist, to see the bolt firing for him with deadly accuracy. Only enough time to see Dorian's eyes widen, and the whole room plunge into ice. The arrow froze mid-flight and dropped to the floor, shattering into 100 pieces. Kaol stared at Dorian in mute horror as his friend's eyes glowed a deep, raging blue, and the prince snarled at the king.
"Don't you touch him."
The ice spread across the room, up the legs of the shocked guards, freezing over Sorsha's blood, and Dorian got to his feet. He raised both hands, and light shimmered along his fingers, a cold breeze whipping through his hair.
"I knew you had it, boy,"
the king started, standing. But Dorian threw out a hand and the king was blasted into his chair by a gust of frozen wind, the window behind him shattering. Wind roared into the room, drowning out all sound. All sound except Dorian's words as he turned to Kaol, his hands and clothes soaked with Sorsha's blood.
"Run, and when you come back..."
The king was getting to his feet, but another wave of Dorian's magic slammed into him, knocking him down. There were tears staining Dorian's bloody cheeks now.
"When you come back," the prince said, "burn this place to the ground."
A wall of crackling black hurtled toward them from behind the throne.
"Go,"
Dorian ordered, turning toward the onslaught of his father's power. Light exploded from Dorian, blocking out the wave, and the entire castle shook. People screamed, and Kaol's knees buckled. For a moment, he debated making a stand with his friend, right there and then. But he knew that this had been the other trap. One for Adian and Aelin. One for Sorsha. And this one. This one to draw out Dorian's power. Dorian had known it too. Known it, and still walked into it so Kaol could escape. To find Aelin and tell her what had happened here today. Someone had to get out. Someone had to survive. He looked at his friend, perhaps for the last time, and said what he had always known from the moment they'd met, when he'd understood that the prince was his brother in soul.
I love you.
Dorian merely nodded, eyes still blazing, and lifted his hands again toward his father. Brother. Friend. King. As another wave of the king's power filled the room, Kaol shoved through the still frozen guards and fled. Adian knew everything had gone to hell as the castle shuddered, but he was already on his way to the dungeons, bound from head to toe. It had been such an easy choice to make. When the captain had been about to take the fall for both of them, he'd thought only of Aelin. What it would do to her if her friend died. Even if he never got to see her, it was still better than having to face her when he explained that the captain was dead. From the sound of it, it seemed the prince was providing a distraction so the captain could flee, and because there was no way in hell the prince would let his father go unpunished for that woman's death. So Adian Ashriver let himself be led into the darkness. He did not bother with prayers, for himself or for the captain. The gods had not helped him these past 10 years, and they would not save him now. He did not mind dying, though he still wished he'd gotten a chance to see her. Just once. Dorian slammed into the marble floor, where the puddle of Sorsha's blood had now melted. Even as his father sent a wave of blinding, burning black power crashing onto him, filling his mouth and his veins, even as he screamed, all he could see was that moment, when the sword cut through flesh and tendon and bone. He could still see her wide eyes, her hair glimmering in the light as it, too, was severed. He should have saved her. It had been so sudden. But when the arrow had fired at Kaol, that was the death he could not endure. Kaol had drawn his line, and Dorian was on his side of it. Kaol had called him his king. So revealing his power to his father did not frighten him. No. To save his friend, dying did not scare him one bit. The blast of power receded, and Dorian was left panting on the stones. He had nothing left. Kaol had gotten away. It was enough. He reached out an arm toward where Sorsha's body lay. His arm burned. Maybe it was broken. Or maybe it was his father's power still branding him. But he reached for her nonetheless. By the time his father stood over him, he'd managed to move his hand a few inches.
Do it.
Dorian rasped. He was choking. On blood and the gods knew what.
Oh, I don't think so,
his father said, digging a knee into his chest.
It won't be death for you, my gifted son.
There was something dark and gleaming in his father's hands. Dorian fought like hell against the guards now pinning his arms, trying to drag up any ounce of power, as his father brought the collar of Wordstone toward his neck. A collar, like the ones worn by those things Kaol had said were in the Dead Islands.
No.
No.
He was screaming it. Screaming it because he'd seen that creature in the catacombs and heard what was being done to Roland and Caltaine. He had seen what a mere ring could do. This was an entire collar, with no visible keyhole.
Hold him still,
his father barked, digging his knee in deeper. The breath was sucked from his chest, and his ribs groaned in agony. But there was nothing Dorian could do to stop it. He wrenched his arm from one of the guards, wrenched it free and reached, bellowing. He had just touched Sorsha's limp hand when cool stone gripped his throat. There was a faint click and hiss, and the darkness swept in to tear him apart. Kaol ran. He did not have the time to take anything except what he had on him as he sprinted like hell for Dorian's rooms. Fleetfoot was waiting, as she had been all night, and he scooped her over a shoulder and hauled her to Selena's room and into the secret passage. Down and down they went, the dog unusually obedient. Three blasts shook the castle, shaking dust from the stones above. He kept running, knowing each blast meant Dorian was alive a bit longer, and dreading the silence to come. Hope. That was what he carried with him. The hope of a better world that Adian and Sorsha and Dorian had sacrificed themselves for. He made one stop, with Fleetfoot still gripped over his shoulder. With a silent prayer to the gods for their forgiveness, Kaol hurtled into the tomb to grab Damaris, shoving the sacred blade through his belt and stuffing a few handfuls of gold into his cloak pockets. And though the skull-shaped knocker didn't move, he told Mort precisely where he would be.
Just in case she comes back. In case she doesn't know.
Mort remained stationary. But Kaol had the sense he'd been listening all the same, as he grabbed the satchel containing Dorian and Selena's magic books and fled to the passage that would take him to the sewer tunnel. A few minutes later, he was raising the heavy iron grate over the sewer stream. The outside beyond was wholly dark and still. As he heaved Fleetfoot back into his arms to swing them both around the wall and onto the stream bank beyond, the castle went silent. There were screams, yes, but silence lurked beneath them. He did not want to know if Dorian was alive or dead. He couldn't decide which was worse. When Kaol got to the hidden apartment, Ren was pacing.
Where's...
There was blood on him, he realized. The spray from Sorsha's neck. Kaol didn't know how he found the words, but he told Ren what had happened.
So it's just us?
Ren asked quietly. Kaol nodded. Fleetfoot was sniffing around in the apartment, having made her inspection and decided Ren wasn't worth eating. Even after Ren had protested that the dog might draw too much attention. She was staying. That was non-negotiable. A muscle feathered in Ren's jaw.
Then we find a way to free Adian. As soon as possible. You and me. Between your knowledge of the castle and my contacts, we can find a way.
Then he whispered.
You said Dorian's woman was a healer?
When Kaol nodded, Ren looked like he was about to be sick, but he asked,
Was she named Sorsha? You were the friend she sent those letters to,
Kaol breathed.
I kept pressing her for information, kept...
Ren covered his face and took a shuddering breath. When his eyes at last met Kaol's, they were bright. Slowly, Ren held out a hand.
You and me will find a way to free them.
both Adian and your prince.
Kaol didn't hesitate as he gripped the rebel's outstretched hand.